45 minutes later, the telephone rang again. Kate answered, smiled, and punched the phone into speaker mode. "Utna," said Griffin's voice. "Right here," said Utna. "Kate, you're the one sitting by the desk?" "Yep," said Kate. Utna looked quizzical. "Okay. Utna, just stand right where you are. You don't have to hold your breath or anything, but try not to move around too much."
Okay, said Utna. "But what?"
Suddenly, Morgan 412 turned blue and disappeared, disintegrating with a high-pitched, shimmery sound and then reintegrating as another room. This was rather larger and had gray metal bulkheads for walls instead of the beige-painted cinder blocks of Morgan 412. It had two levels, a lower level with black-painted diamond steel decking and a little control pedestal, and a raised platform two steps up. There, the floor appeared to be glass, with six lighted discs, one of which Utna was standing on. Griffin was standing behind the control column, wearing a broad smile and an odd sort of uniform, a black two-piece outfit cut like a jumpsuit with a ribbed grayish-blue yoke on the shoulders. He came out from behind the controls as Utna made her way down the two steps, then turned around to look with awe back into the raised alcove where she'd appeared. "Sorry for the lack of warning," he said, "but I always like to see people's faces when they're beamed for the first time, and I figured you'd have the adaptability to handle it." Utna looked at the platform again, then turned to him and said with a smile, "I'll get you for that, Mr. Hutchins." As he led her from the room into a gently curving corridor, he winced. "If you must be formal, then here on board ship it's Captain." Utna nodded complacently and replied, "Of course, Captain Hutchins." Griffin held the door to what appeared to be an elevator and sighed. "I liked it better when you called me Griffin Sensei. Anyway, welcome aboard the Experts of Justice Starship Challenger. We've only got about an hour," he added, fixing her with a look that struck her as uncharacteristically serious. "So I'll get right to the point. At 7:05, Corwin Ravenhair was standing around in Morgan 412 waiting for Utna to get back and feeling unaccountably nervous. Caitlin was very kindly not hassling him about that, though it was obvious. He had just turned to ask her if maybe they should call or something when a distinctive shimmering hum filled the room, along with the blue-white glare that signaled the use of a Zeta Cygni-type transporter. Utna's form resolved in the middle of the room, near her armchair, and then the glow faded, and there she was. Kate and Corwin both stared at her, astounded, because she was wearing a uniform, but not the one she'd left in. This one, while also black and scarlet, was of a markedly different style. The jacket was cut to high thigh length and looked to be of black gabardine, double-breasted but buttonless, with a black leather belt kilting it at the waist and scarlet piping. She wore it over a bright red ribbed turtleneck shirt, sharply cut black dress trousers with a scarlet stripe down the outseam, and her signature black and white saddle shoes. Hanging from the belt was the thorn of the rose. That wasn't so remarkable, perhaps, but for the various embellishments to the jacket. It had an inch-wide, bright red strap surmounting the right shoulder and fastening together the corner of the chest flap. From the end of that strap, a silver chain hung down halfway to the belt before curving back up to end high on the left breast, at a silver ring encircling an eight-pointed crimson and scarlet star pin, cardinal points enlarged, southernmost elongated, against a transverse silver bar. The left shoulder sported a scarlet and silver medallion epaulette. The sleeves ended in broad white cuffs with bright red edging, the left one sporting the same three-barred, trefoil-pointed, oblong silver pin as the shoulder strap. Underneath the kilted tails of the jacket, a short white petticoat stood out bright against the black material of jacket and trousers. Utna unslung a silvery duffel bag emblazoned with the ship's seal of the Starship Challenger, and tossed it onto the chair behind her, then held her hands out to her sides, feeling a little silly, but also oddly proud as she let them take her in.
Well, she asked, what do you think?
Corwin just stood and stared. Caitlin came over and slowly walked around her, examining the outfit with a critical eye. The scarlet trim stripes on the double swing back, the silver button affixing the backside of the shoulder strap, the trapezoidal belt buckle with six gleaming silver studs.
That's a Klingon warrior's belt, she observed.
Yep, Utrina replied.
Well, why are you wearing a Klingon warrior's belt?
Utina gestured vaguely to the duffel bag. Because I can't wear the baldric with this jacket, and it'd cover my rank bar, she replied, as though that ought to have been obvious.
Corwin blinked and found his tongue. The first word that came off it was, Captain?
Utina glanced at the rank bar.
That's what they tell me. Your dad was just wearing these five little brass deals here, she added, touching the right side of her turtleneck collar. Two dots and three slashes.
That's how they do it on the duty uniforms. That's a dress uniform. An International Police Space Force captain's dress uniform. Where did you get that?
Which, as soon as he asked it, Corbin recognized as an exceedingly stupid question. She'd just beamed into the room and mentioned his father. Where did he think she'd gotten it, Moonbase Alpha?
Fortunately, Utina seemed to recognize it as a stupid question too, but didn't seem inclined to rag him about it. She just smiled at him instead of answering it. It was only then that she seemed to realize how he was dressed, and slowly she took a couple of steps back to take it in. Like hers, it was mostly black. Like hers, it had stripes on the outseams of the trousers, though in Corwin's case they were silver, and the pants themselves fuller, uncreased, bloused into shiny black boots with shining silver spurs. He wore a high-collared, notch-throated, silver-edged black tunic, and over it a rich black velvet tabard, ornately and beautifully brocaded with complex, almost mathematical patterns, and belted at his waist with a broad belt that sported a buckle with a crossed silver thunderbolts motif. Silver bracers with black enameled engraving gleamed on both wrists. Over it all he wore a double cloak, full-length with half-length overcape, of black lined with silver, fastened at his throat with the silver rose Utrina had given him for Christmas.
"Oh, wow," she remarked. "Look at you! What is that?" she wanted to know.
Reddening somewhat, Corwin replied, "It's my Valkyrie dress uniform. You like it?"
"Corwin, it's beautiful. Look at that pattern, my God!"
She came up and ran her hand down part of the embroidered pattern, feeling the cool metallic sheen of the thread and the softness of the velvet.
"Is that metal?"
He nodded. "Silver. It's actually the projector web for a body shield. It's a dress uniform, but we're expected to wear them into battle if we have to."
"Well, that's practical," she said approvingly.
"Nall sends his regards," Corwin went on. He was going to come along, but Aunt Belle persuaded him to go back to Tomodachi with her tonight instead. Now he's sure there's a Keep Nall Off Earth conspiracy. Not that she had to twist his tail very hard, he added with a confidential grin. He's a slave to her tuna casserole. That drew a laugh from both girls. There came a knock at the door. Caitlin brightened and went to answer it. It was, as she had expected, Miki Kaworu, who was wearing his Hattori Academy student counselor's uniform and smiling a little shyly as Kate admitted him.
"Now that's the Miki I remember," said Utrina, grinning.
"I don't know what you're referring to," replied Miki with a pious air. Then he took out his stopwatch and tripped it, which was about as far as he got before he couldn't keep a straight face any longer. It was Wakaba Shinohara who observed during the pre-dance gathering of the duelists in the wedge that they had enough Hattori Academy student counselors to convene a quorum. No one would even have had to change offices. She'd been president, Sayonji vice president, albeit not at the same time. What a mess that would have been. Miki secretary and Juri treasurer. "We're like a government in exile," she mused,
brushing some imaginary lint from the sleeve of her black uniform jacket. Sionji looked from one to the next, then shrugged and turned to Utena. "I suppose," he said dryly, "that makes your roommate the end of the world." Utena scowled at him. "That's not funny, Sionji," she said. He looked apologetic. "No, I'm sorry, it's not. But it is ironic. I've learned to appreciate irony." "Could you learn to appreciate being stuffed into your own mailbox by Dorothy?" "Probably not." "Then never joke about the end of the world to me again," said Utena, her tone deceptively light. "Done," said Sionji gravely. "I'm sorry." Then he brightened. "Still, if we are to be the Otori Academy Student Council in exile, at least we have you here to be the official thorn in our side. Quickly, everyone, let's plot some fiendish conspiracy so Tencho can ruin it." It was a clumsy effort, but Utena appreciated it for what it was, an attempt to make up for his ill-chosen comment by making a joke, and she appreciated it enough to give him an only slightly weak grin and a friendly punch in the shoulder to let him know he was forgiven. Then, to change the subject entirely, she complimented Dorothy on her dress. "Thank you," said Dorothy with a little smile. She did look very good, formal and demure, but somehow adventurous at the same time. The dress was mainly scarlet, with subtle circuitry-like patterns in silver thread on the broad black yoke and elbow-length black satin gloves. "That's an Aunt Belle original, isn't it?" Corwin inquired. Dorothy smiled a little wider and nodded. "She sent it to me as a late Christmas present," she said. "For a special time," she said. "At the time, I didn't know what she was talking about." Utena grinned. "And now you do?" she asked. "Now," said Dorothy with an air of tentative confidence, "I have a hypothesis." "What ho, comrades?" said the reedy voice of Devlin Carter from the Daniels Hall side entrance. He was wearing the most bizarre outfit any of them had ever seen him in, much stranger than his usual t-shirt, jeans, old trench coat garb, and nowhere near the same formal wear league as the tux he'd worn for the spring concert. This looked more like a military uniform of some kind, with a sky-blue jacket, white jodhpurs, and mirror-shiny black patent leather jackboots. All he was missing was a blaster at his belt and some insignia, and he'd have been able to pass for a Neudeutscher astrofighter pilot. He was even wearing a monocle. Amanda Dessler, on his arm, was wearing an equally odd getup that looked to be half dress uniform, half ball gown, a tailored sleeveless jacket with a sword belt and a rustly bell skirt. Utena felt a peculiar pang of nostalgia, like last weekend's, but not so sharp, looking at it. It was the wrong color, and for that matter, so was Amanda, but the dress reminded her of home all the same. Behind them came Moose McEachern in a clawhammer tuxedo that looked like it had been cut to fit the Michelin man and then let out a bit, and Azalin Devere Natoshkin, who described what she wore as traditional Dantrovian formal garb, altered to fit this planet's dress code. It consisted of a close-fitting two-piece bodysuit of some shimmery scarlet material, with latticed edging on neckline, short sleeves, and leggings, under a pleated white garment that was like a cross between a sari and a toga, a continuous piece of white cloth that was wrapped, much pleated, around her waist and then the excess several feet thrown over one shoulder. Utena guessed that the Earth-friendly modification involved adding the bodysuit. Certainly the golden circlets at wrists and ankles would be worn on Dantrov, though you wouldn't find many native Dantrovians on that world with a Vulcan Idik pendant. Mia and Skaya arrived shortly thereafter. Mia looked warm and comfortable, but also rather regal, in the dress version of her Minbari Anlashak uniform, which was made of richer fabrics and sported fuller cuts than the battle version she wore to duelist meetings. Skaya looked, well, rather garish, really, in the most ornate and formal version yet seen of the scarlet and white silks he wore for special occasions, this one embellished with a lot of gold and some other precious-looking metal, copper-colored but much deeper sheened and finer than that common element. He sported a ceremonial-looking dagger on his belt in addition to his usual scrangish saber, for all the duelists had agreed that they would go armed to the formal, not because they expected trouble, but to show their solidarity. Against the sword-bedecked panoply of her followers, Kate looked slightly out of place with the unobtrusive black-stained length of Kotetsu no Sasiaki, her Zatoichi. The blade had been designed not to look like a weapon, after all. Perhaps, she mused to herself, it's time I broke down and asked Dad for a proper daisho after all. One of the drawbacks of WPI's secondary function is what the North American Historical Preservation Directorate referred to as working history, was that, since it was an only slightly updated copy of Worcester Polytechnic Institute circa 1991, it lacked truly adequate facilities for some functions. The spring concert was one example. Another was the spring formal. Harrington Auditorium, across the quad from Daniels Hall, could house a student dance without much difficulty. But despite its name, the auditorium was essentially a gymnasium. It had nowhere near the elegance required for anything like the spring formal. So, as with the spring concert, the school outsourced. The spring formal took place in the grand ballroom of the Worcester Crown Plaza Hotel. Utena Tenjo had been to the Crown Plaza twice before, but she'd only seen the lobby, the elevators, and the palace suite, so the grand ballroom was a new experience. Not an entirely unexpected one, though. She'd been in a grand ballroom before, just not this one. They were really all much the same. The whole thing was staged a bit, obviously, but that was part of the experience. First, they arrived in the lobby of the great hotel, checked their coats, if they had them, and signed in with Miss Montaigne. Then they were photographed, two by two, against the backdrop next to the Dean of Student Life's temporary desk. After that, there was the traditional chit-chat, loitering around in the hotel lobby while the Chamberlain, Professor Krog of the Linguistics Department, chosen for the honor on account of his great, booming Klingon voice, announced them, two by two, into the ballroom. The professor got his information via datapad from Miss Montaigne, indicating how they wanted to be announced was part of the signing-in procedure. It all ran very smoothly and added a certain air of gravity and importance to the proceedings. As they were announced, each pair of students entered through the main doors and descended the grand staircase to the ballroom floor, where they would be greeted by President and Mrs. Tiefeld. After that, things were pretty freeform. There was a buffet, provided by volunteer students and faculty from the Institute's Culinary Arts Department. The music was provided by a professional orchestra, giving the school's own musicians the night off. Caitlin, who had never really had occasion to meet him before, had developed considerable respect and fondness for Professor Krog in the weeks since the Klingon had become the Institute Duelist Society's faculty advisor. Her opinion of him was increased another notch as he drew himself up grandly and announced, Skaya Vorikoshiga R. Ixtixta Kitul Thakul Vrihel Dishkarat of Barsave and Miss Mia Ausa. This announcement was, after all, quite a remarkable achievement. The only other being Kate had ever heard pronounce Skaya's full name correctly was Skaya himself. Kate noted two figures working behind the buffet, and smiled as she realized that Galaxy House's non-duelist contingent had made it to the formal after all, after a fashion. Neither Jacron nor Mac ever showed any interest in the female student body at WPI. Jacron pleaded the species barrier, and Mac said quietly that he only knew 9 women in all the student body of girls, 8 of whom were members of the duelist's clique, and of the 9 none was sufficiently distracting to him to pull him away from his studies. A couple of them, upon hearing this pronouncement, felt distinctly, if impersonally, slighted, but at least one couldn't accuse Harcourt Mackenzie of mincing words. Thus, when a teammate of Jacron's from the third-year class discovered their lack of plans, the two had been drafted to staff the banquet table so that the third-year class volunteers could go off and have some fun. Apparently rented tuxedos had been part of the deal. As with most rental clothes, neither fit precisely right. Mac's arms and legs seemed to slide out of the cuffs just a hair farther than a proper tailor would have permitted, and Jacron looked as if one righteously outraged bellow would tear the whole thing asunder. Despite this, they managed to look snappy. Jacron's hide was polished to a brilliant sheen, and Mac's rumpled brown hair had been brushed and trimmed to almost a military cut, tall and flat on top, very short on the sides, only a couple of long, untrimmed bangs in front ruining the martial look. Jacron had chosen to accept the menial position with pride, and he dished out every cup of punch and arranged every fresh tray of niblets with ebullient charm. Mac, however, Kate didn't see very much of Mac, but then few people saw him in general, besides Jacron and lately Moose. He tended to stay in Galaxy House except for classes, very special events, and three trips into town a week for some unknown purpose. In Galaxy House, though, and his rare appearances at Alden for bass guitar lessons, Mac had a definite air of self-confidence. Here, among other people, he seemed just a little out of place, uncertain of himself. He also looked, she noted to herself as she accepted a cup of punch from Jacron, just as distracted as when he'd sat in the third row at the orchestra concert taking notes. Mac didn't miss anything, and no one had to ask him twice for anything, but his thoughts were clearly somewhere else.
"You're wondering what's the matter,"
Jacron murmured in Kate's ear, and she nearly dumped her punch all over his rented tux.
Don't do that,
Kate gasped. Jacron made a brief gesture of apology before continuing,
"I'm afraid I pushed Mac into being here tonight. He has no social life at all. Humans are social animals, or so I am frequently told."
Jacron grunted in irritation at the old homily.
"But I have seldom seen a human so reluctant to associate with his own kind as our good man Mackenzie."
Kate nodded, sensing a possible Narn tirade about to erupt and not wanting to encourage it. Jacron surprised her, however, by adding in a soft, sympathetic voice,
"He told me once that he feels more comfortable around the aliens than the humans here."
"Oh?" Kate's curiosity took control of her voice 1 second before her self-preservation could wrestle it to the ground.
"He says I remind him of home," Jacron said. "I have to wonder where Mac comes from, that he regards Earthers with such contempt and aliens almost as family."
A moment later, he added hurriedly,
"You should realize, you and the other humans in the Duelist Society aren't classified as Earthers to him."
"And what about you?" Utna had managed, without really intending it, to sneak up behind the two and listen to the conversation.
"I," said Jacron with a smile, "find everything and anything objectionable. Hadn't you heard?"
He waggled his brow ridge as he said it, and the three broke up laughing for a moment. When he recovered, Jacron added,
"I suppose I like humanity as a whole, although there are quite a number of individual examples of the genome I should prefer to live without. I just see so much everywhere that could be made so much better if people only made an effort."
No doubt against whatever rules buffet servers worked under, Jacron picked a couple of Swedish meatballs out of the tray with his hands and popped them into his mouth. As he wiped his fingers with a napkin, he added,
"That's why I'm at this school at all. I am here to learn, yes, but more importantly, I am here to make things better. Mark my words, friends, one day I shall change the world."
Only at the last did Jacron approach the level of voice he employed in his rantings, and it ended as he handed a cup of punch to another student with the quiet,
"Here you are, miss. Enjoy."
Utna Tenjo's face wore a faraway, pensive look, and her voice was soft and faintly haunted as she murmured,
"Grant me the power to bring the world revolution."
Jacron caught the words and smiled a bit broader as he looked at the two women.
"My," he said, "that is a fascinating phrase. It fits so well. Would you mind if I used it sometime?"
Utna blinked, startled out of her reverie. She might not have been entirely aware that she'd spoken aloud.
Sure. I didn't coin it originally, anyway," she said absently.
Before Jacron could speak again, or Caitlin expressed concern for the suddenly shuttered look of her roommate's face, Corwin appeared at Utna's side, unaware that anything had happened.
"Ah, Mr. Ravenhair," said Jacron expansively. "So good to see you again, and in such marvelous clothing. I see that, even though not a student of our fine institute, you've taken our charter's message of cultural diversity to heart."
"My heritage is important to me," Corbin agreed with a smile and a nod. "Say, Captain Tencho?"
Utna blinked, then smiled and swatted his arm.
"Yes, Lord Corwin," she replied.
"Would you like to dance?"
Utna grinned.
"It's what we're here for, isn't it?"
Corwin Ravenhair was a surprisingly adept dancer. Not that he was particularly clumsy in any physical activity, at least so far as Utna had yet observed, but still there was something about him that suggested he might be less than polished on that dance floor. Maybe it was the fact that he still hadn't quite grown into his hands and feet yet. It gave him a faint resemblance to a puppy, with the unconscious expectation that he'd be as ungainly as one. But no, he was really quite competent. Utna herself was better at it than one might expect from her usual direct, no-frills approach to motion, but then she'd been taught by experts. Ballroom dancing was one of those things you just learned at Otori Academy. At least, you did if you were planning on becoming a prince when you grew up, even if you did think it was a rather frivolous thing to be doing when there were rescues to be galloping to. At any rate, between the two of them, they made a fairly painless go of it. It was a bit of a mental adjustment for Utna not to be leading, but not a very difficult one. It occurred to her again, as it often did, that Corwin had an ability to put her at ease in the most memory-fraught situations. "He's almost as tall as me now," she thought to herself as they waltzed around the grand ballroom. 4 months I've known him, and he's grown that much. And my God, those eyes!" She blinked. Where'd that come from?
"Something the matter?" he murmured below the music.
"No," she replied, "just thinking." She grinned. "The last time I did this, my date was wearing a tablecloth."
Corwin gave her a puzzled eyebrow lift. "Toga party?"
Utna had a very disturbing mental image as she parsed the question entirely wrong the first time. Once she'd shaken the proper noun out of it and tried again, it made more sense, and she chuckled. The song ended, and as they moved off the floor, she said, "No, not quite. See, the Academy was having a grand ball, and..." "Aw, what a shame," Azalin mused as she sipped at a glass of Epictetan mineral water. "Liza doesn't look like she's having any fun at all." It was a pronouncement that was no less true for being rather catty, for Elizabeth Broadbank did indeed not seem to be having much fun. Her date was as clumsy as Corwin was not, and Liza's insteps were taking the brunt of his folly. "Who is she with?" wondered Amanda Dessler. "I don't think I've ever seen him before. He's certainly not a student."
"Her daddy imported him special for the formal," said Moose in a low voice, like an earthquake trying to whisper. "He's the son of some high mucky-muck in some company as technology's looking to acquire. Goes to Fontainebleau Academy in New Avalon."
"Le Chateau Snouté," said Devlin, raising an eyebrow. "Oh-ho! That explains why Marcus Finch looks like a doused puppy instead of a wet hen, eh, what?"
"Is Finch her fiancé this week?" said Azalin airily. "I can never keep track. Come on, Moose Master, let's go do some dancing." "I hate these slow numbers," Moose grumbled as he obediently followed her onto the dance floor. "Makes me feel like a glacier migrating."
"If you did the Lindy Hop in here, the chandelier would come down," Azalin observed.
"Maybe it'd fall on Liza," said Moose hopefully.
Devlin glanced calmly across the little group of faculty and staff who stood along the back wall of the room, chatting and snacking, and generally trying to look like they were doing something other than chaperoning, which was of course exactly what they were doing. His gaze didn't flicker or pause as it passed Martine Leclerc, but he noticed her all the same.
"Have to be on our guard," he murmured to Amanda. "Miss LeCue is here."
"I am always on my guard, Earthman," Amanda replied, but she was smiling slightly as she said it.
"Dance with me."
"I cannot resist an Imperial command," he replied with a smile. The evening progressed smoothly. Since the orchestra was a multi-mode retro group, capable of switching smoothly from ballroom waltz to big band, Moose McEachern did, in fact, get to dance the Lindy Hop. Contrary to Azalin's prediction, the chandelier did not fall. It did swing a bit, though. On the other hand, wasn't that the whole point of a song like In the Mood, to make the joint swing?
"You know, Wainwright, you've surprised me," said Liza Broadbank breezily as she sidled, as well as anyone can sidle on sore feet, up to Dorothy. She'd been waiting for that opportunity for some time, waiting for the robot girl's date to leave her and go to one of the buffet tables, and now the opportunity had come.
By default, the servos and armatures which drove R. Dorothy Wainwright's main motor functions were silent. For no reason anyone had ever been able to determine, though, she possessed the useless but interesting ability to make them obviously audible if she chose to. And over the course of the semester, her friends had noticed that she tended to do it when she was annoyed or wished to make a sarcastic point out of her robotic nature. She did it now, whirring audibly as she very precisely rotated her head to face the speaker.
"Oh?" she said.
"It's true," said Liza. "I knew you were a love toy, that's obvious. But until tonight I had no idea you were programmed to go either way." Dorothy regarded Liza expressionlessly for a moment, as if weighing her options.
"I appreciate," she said at last, "your confidence that I have feelings to hurt. At the same time, I am insulted that you think they could be hurt so cheaply."
She faced front again, dismissing Liza with her dark, disinterested eyes.
"I was under the impression you thought yourself a clever tormentor."
Then, as Liza stood momentarily speechless, Dorothy turned back as though she'd just thought of something, and added in a coolly inquisitive tone,
"Or was that a clumsily worded proposition?"
Liza flushed scarlet, turned on her heel, and stalked away into the crowd. Dorothy watched her go, then turned and walked the other way, a little smile on her face. Despite the smile, though, and the pleasant feeling of victory over Liza, the robot was concerned. Though human behavior as a whole was still largely a closed subject to her, she learned the responses of some specific humans very well over the last few months, and this knowledge was enough to tell her that Juri Arisugawa wasn't having fun. Oh, she was putting a brave face on it, but Dorothy was an authority on brave faces, and she knew better. Juri was her friend and enjoyed her company, but the redhead didn't want to be here. At least, not with Dorothy. The robot girl paused for a moment as her positronic matrix mulled over possible courses of action. The solution that presented itself was both pleasingly elegant and just outright pleasing. Her smile slightly widened as she altered her course a few degrees to starboard and intercepted Caitlin and Miki leaving the dance floor.
"Hello, Miss Dorothy," said Miki, smiling. "Are you having a good time?"
"Intermittently," Dorothy replied.
"Caitlin, may I borrow your date?"
Kate blinked, surprised by the bluntness of the request, then smiled.
Sure, if he doesn't mind being loaned.
"Not at all," said Miki.
Kate released his arm and he offered it to Dorothy. As she went to one of the long tables to get something to drink, Kate wondered what the vaguely conspiratorial look Dorothy had given her was supposed to have meant. Juri stood in the corner, alone, arms folded, and wondered if she would ever, ever learn. It was supposed to be a human trait to learn from mistakes. Everything she'd ever read on the subject had been confident about that. It was 100 different kinds of axiom. Mistakes are how we learn. Santayana had maintained that those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. One would think an obvious corollary to that would be that those who do remember the past would be spared the trouble. That didn't seem to be the case, though. Jury remembered the past quite well, even dwelt upon it, and yet she seemed capable of nothing but repetition. She leaned against the wall and scanned the dance floor. Azalin and Moose should have been hilarious, like a cat waltzing with a minivan, what with a nearly 3-foot disparity in their heights and God only knew what multiplier's difference in tonnage. But Azalin was nothing if not adaptable, and somehow she'd managed to come up with a way of dancing with the Hoffmanite that didn't look either ridiculous or dangerous. Sionji and Wakaba went disturbingly well with each other, all the more so now that he'd shed that air of monomaniacal desperation that had always lingered around him at the academy, and she'd traded her doe-eyed devotion for a healthier combination of self-assurance and frank attraction. He didn't seem to know just what to make of her, and it was obvious that that suited Wakaba just fine. The image was one of the few sources of amusement Jury found in tonight's situation. You wouldn't think a creature with a 6-foot tail would find it all that easy to dance in a crowded ballroom, but Skaya's natural grace carried him through. Jury wondered where Mia had learned to dance. Did they have books on that subject in the great library of Yedor? Tenjo and Ravenhair. What a stir they'd made when Professor Krolg had boomed out their names. Odd costumes were no rare thing at the WPI Spring Formal, but the double punch of that uniform Tenjo had on and Ravenhair's peculiar finery had set the room buzzing. Tenjo often had that effect, of course, and with Kate's brother next to her it was only amplified. They really did look good together, and after striking her truce with Azalin, Jury had come to know him well enough to recognize that he was a good man. She regretted the fall she knew he was setting himself up for, but Azalin had been right after all. There was nothing for Jury to do about it. It wasn't as if he'd believe her if she tried to warn him. Would she have believed, after all, if anyone had tried to warn her? Dorothy was out there, dancing with Miki. Jury didn't grudge her that. After all, she'd practically abandoned the poor girl to come over here and have this little snit. But then, Jury doubted that Dorothy had really expected anything much from her tonight anyway. The thing had been arranged half in jest to stop Azalin from pestering them. Jury would have sighed, except that it would have broken her studied impassivity. Is this, she wondered, going to be a continuing pattern in my life? You may as well admit it to yourself, at least, Arasugawa. You've escaped one dead end only to run down another. Idly, some part of her not involved in this bit of internal recrimination wondered, if Miki Kaworu was dancing with Dorothy, what had become of... Looks like we've lost our dates, said Caitlin with a smile, as she crossed into Jury's roughly circular zone of annoyance, paying it no mind. Said Jury. Kate regarded the redhead thoughtfully for a moment, then said with elaborate deliberation, "You present the appearance of a woman with a problem." "It's nothing," said Jury automatically. Kate nodded as if convinced. "Well," she said, "in that case, let's not go somewhere and talk about it." Jury looked momentarily surprised, then slowly smiled. "Let's not," she agreed. And so they did.